You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 30th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me here tonight are Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Namaste.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Right.
How are you all doing tonight?
Good.
Super. Pretty good, Steve.
Not too
What's
good
up?
Yourself?
Good. Very good. Very good. We have coming up later in the show, we have an interview with Dr. Kimball Atwood, who is very active in evaluating the claims of naturopathy or naturopathy. So we'll be talking about that for a while. But first, let's go to some news items. There are a couple of Vatican-related news items in the news this past week. The first one is growing speculation that the new pope is about to accept intelligent design. I'm sure you guys have read about
Holy
this.
Holy Jesus.
It would be just, you know, beyond terrible if that happened.
Yeah. So,
I mean, you know, really.
What are the ramifications of that?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say exactly what they would do. Obviously, you know, within the scientific community, they would be none. They, but within, you know, there's over a billion Catholics in the world. You know, it's a it's one of the major religions, from what I hear. And, you know, from what I understand, the Pope is a little influential within the Catholic religion.
You know, all I have to say is it's a good thing that the Pope is infallible.
Yeah.
Because wait a minute, didn't the last Pope say that evolution was a fact?
It's true. Last guy said it was more than a theory.
Shouldn't all their heads just explode at this point?
like the scanners guy?
Seriously, it's just pathetic. I'm sorry, it's completely pathetic that we even have to worry.
Well, is he actually saying it's science, or is he saying that the church endorses it because it goes with his concept of God?
Well, he's not saying anything yet. He's holding some kind of a conference on this issue. And but, you know, the people who have been following this say that the signs are there, that since this new pope has come on, that the church has made a lot of comments that point to them moving in this direction. One prominent anti-evolutionist Catholic scientist, Dominique Tassot, told the U.S. National Catholic Reporter that they're having a meeting to give a broader extension to the debate, as if, you know, there is a real debate. Even if the Pope knows where he wants to go, and I believe he does, it will take some time. Oh, yeah. So, you know, if he's given any indication of where he wants to go, it's away from evolution.
How mind-numbing is it that these church officials are going to argue about intelligent design and evolution?
Right.
Like, that makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I'm a lapsed Catholic. You know, I haven't been to church in about, 20 years. How can I remove myself further?
Right. You can get excommunicated.
That's
it. Cast you into the outer darkness.
I'm holding out hope, though, that the majority of Catholics, you know,
will shrug it off.
Yeah, that they're Catholics in name, but when it comes to their everyday life, they're actually thinking for themselves and stuff.
You can always hope.
The PR will be a disaster, though.
I think it'll be worse for them than it will be for science, to be honest with you. Here's one statement by the Pope in his inaugural sermon. He made the following statement: "We are not the accidental product without meaning of evolution." So that might give some idea as to where he's leaning.
I don't find it very shocking. Maybe I'm just a horrible cynic.
It's interesting that he's going to embrace the theory of intelligent design. Why doesn't he just call it creationism? I mean, what is the Pope afraid of? Why does he have to cloak himself with the term intelligent design?
It has the patina of science, and Catholics do try to portray themselves as being scholarly, you know, of the Christian, you know, denominations. They do.
That's the whole tragedy of it. I did always consider Catholics a little more erudite than many other Christian sects, certainly those more fundamental, but this puts a knife in it.
With the exception of the Pope, though. I mean, especially the current one.
Well, I mean, I'll wait for the edict, you know, the bull, but...
The bull. Never the more aptly
bull.
Named.
The papal bull. Yeah, the papal bull is right.
Certainly it's going to be papal bull.
As a bunch of papal bull.
The other Pope/Catholic item in the news this week, the Pope, you know, Pope Benedict the 16th, he has an official caster out of demons. And he made This is Father Amorth. And Father Amorth made the following statement on Vatican Radio recently. He said, "Of course the devil exists, and he can not only possess a single person, but also groups and entire populations. I am convinced that the Nazis were all possessed. All you have to do is think about what Hitler and Stalin did. Almost certainly they were possessed by the devil." There you go.
Oh. So therefore they're not guilty by reason of possession.
By reason of possession.
Actually innocent people that were not acting of their own accord.
Right.
Oh, so here's the thing. Imagine though that your job title is Caster Out of Demons. Yeah. And it is currently 2006. Just put yourself in his shoes for just 1 second and just think, what would you do to keep your job? You've got to be on the verge. You know that you are a remnant of the Middle Ages. You have to come up with something. So what are you going to do? Go for the Nazi demon thing.
Yeah. What does the Pope do? Say, summon my Caster Out of Demons.
I think the Pope is sitting there thinking, who is that dude? And his advisor leans over, "Sir, that's your Caster Out of Demons." And the Caster Out of Demons is sitting there like, oh my God, I am totally going to lose my job. So, he calls up the radio station. Hey, let me tell you about demons.
apparently, Pope Pius XII, who was Pope when Hitler was in charge, tried a long-distance exorcism on Hitler, but it didn't work.
Wow.
How'd that work out?
Didn't work. Didn't take.
Didn't work.
Imagine that guy filling out an application for a credit card. Occupation, Caster Out of Demons. No, for real. I'm not kidding. I do that.
So the logical fallacy in that statement, which I feel compelled to point out, is, of course, the major unstated premise, which is that people who are not possessed are not capable of committing these horrendous atrocities, which is a very dangerous thing to believe. I mean, we have to understand human nature and why Hitler was what he was and why it was possible for him to capture a nation, for a nation such as Germany during World War II, to do the things that they did.
Yeah.
To say, just to fluff it all off as demonic possession is to miss the point, to miss the lesson of history and to understand human nature. It's very, very destructive, actually, as much as we'd like to make fun of it, because it is kind of silly.
Are you saying it's juvenile, asinine, and thoughtless?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's basically the flip side of what happens when when someone credits God for doing things that humans are doing, like, EMTs come upon a terrible accident and save someone's life, and it's declared a miracle that they survived, but it's not a miracle.
Thank God. Thank the guy who saved your life and the science that gave him the tools to do it.
And God is never blamed for the accident.
Yeah,
that's Satan.
That's Satan, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's Satan.
Quick follow-up from last week when we recorded the show last week. The United International Astronomers did not yet make their pronouncement on the definition of a planet. They did the next day. And sadly, Pluto is no longer a planet. So our solar system is now officially down to 8 planets and, at present, 3 what are going to be called dwarf planets. Ceres and Pluto are dwarf planets. Charon will remain just a satellite of Pluto.
And Xena is a dwarf planet, too.
And the body which is designated, although not officially named, Xena.
Oh, shut up.
It's not official yet.
Everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say Xena. You don't need to say the body formerly known
warrior
as Xena.
Warrior princess.
Yeah, wasn't she a warrior princess? Is
of
that
course.
The,
From 93 to 97.
Yes, it was unofficially designated as Xena.
Alas, poor Pluto, we hardly knew ye.
There's a certain symmetry to the 8, though, where we now have 4 inner planets, 4 outer planets, so even numbers.
Why do you need to be so divisive?
Pluto was really just kind of a little ball of ice.
Can't we say that scientists have corrected a mistake for so long and is now correctly classifying Pluto instead of saying Pluto's demoted or Pluto is kicked out of the club or sort of this negative connotation?
I don't think we should assign any emotional value to it. You have to just go with the science.
Oh, you have to assign emotional value to it. I mean, come on.
What, are you going
to
cry over the fact that they're reclassifying Pluto?
Yeah, I am. I already did.
There is something very romantic about astronomy, I have to say, and the planets and the galaxies and everything. I do think that there is a certain I don't know, human emotion attached to it. But
I say F that ball of ice and rock.
Hey, you,
good riddance to it.
We're, 2 weeks ago, bully. Weren't you saying bully for Pluto? Now you're saying,
you know,
F it?
I wouldn't have minded.
So fickle.
But it's done. It's out.
Yeah, the science wasn't out 2 weeks ago.
I've moved on.
Perry's
moved
affections
on.
Are fickle.
I have new planets now I'm interested in.
Like X-25,
Stop
Delta
calling
4.
Pluto, God.
Out.
He's so needy.
I do have to say that I am wrapping my mind around the notion that we only have 8 planets much quicker than I thought I would. It's been a much smoother transition than I
feared
it would
be. You know,
be.
They say that it takes about half as long as you were together to get over being apart. So
that does beg the question, though, Steve.
That's
how are you going to explain to your daughters, honeys, I've been wrong all these years?
I already did.
Well, that's
Julia.
Problem solved.
Was very accepting of the fact that Pluto is now a dwarf planet.
Well, I'll tell you, this whole thing turns into one of those facts that people will be quizzed on like 5 years on the street. So is Pluto one of the planets? And everyone will think yes, and no one will know it isn't anyway.
Well, no, it'll be like, well, I don't know, they did that thing. And yeah.
I don't think anyone knows about that thing except us.
Yeah. Might be
a few people. A few.
That's optimistic. You know, we have like 4,000 listeners, right?
And growing.
All 4,000 of our listeners know.
That's right.
Thank you.
I'm pretty sure 2,000 are my mother, but still.
Oh, God.
She totally knows.
Madonna has managed to foist herself into the news in the last couple of weeks.
I'm shocked, shocked.
She and her husband, Guy Ritchie, have been harassing the British government. You might say petitioning, but I think that harassing is probably a better term, that they have the solution to nuclear waste.
That's right.
Madonna believes that nuclear waste is the biggest problem in the world today. The planet's not going to be here in 50 years because it's going to be buried in nuclear waste.
Science says that the planet's not going to be here in 50
but
years.
But fortunately, she has the solution. She has the magic water. That magically makes all of the radioactivity go away.
Can she even hear herself?
You had me at magic. I'm convinced.
Magic coffee enemas?
It's a magical Kabbalah fluid.
Does this fluid come out of her husband? What is this?
Actually, so Madonna and her husband are both members of Kabbalah, which is a mystical Judaic cult, really.
You're so mean with the way you say that, Steve.
Yeah, I know.
Such a bite.
Well, it's a... They're not even good enough for Scientology.
Let's see. How about this, Jay? I'll change it. They're second-rate numerologists.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay.
It's much nicer.
So they, whatever, part of their mysticism, I don't know, I think they bless it or whatever, they have this magical fluid, and they claim that they were able to remove the radioactivity from some lake in Russia. Of course,
I'd like to test that we can bring in a barrel of radioactive material into their home.
We could put Madonna and Guy Ritchie in with
Perry, they cannot waste their precious time and resources testing this. They have a world to save from nuclear waste.
She could be like the radioactive material girl.
It would take nothing. She could squat over the barrel.
Remember when she was like new and hot in the 80s and we were all young or partially unborn if you're Rebecca, but... You know, remember when she was cool and all that, and now she's creating, like, the cure for radioactive material?
Well, here's the thing. The thing with Madonna, though, she's still, every now and again, she's still kind of cool. Like, she crucifies herself on stage and pisses off, you know, millions of people, and it's hysterical. But then, you know, she goes...
And she does this. I love one official said this. I love this quote. It was like a crank call. The scientific mechanisms and principles were just bullocks, basically.
can't you see them all standing around the lab saying, "It's Madonna. She says she has water. What do I do?
What happened? Her water broke? What?
Yeah, well, who?
Who? I mean, come on. By the way, I just want to say for the record, I never thought the woman was cool. Okay, country, western, and folk music. Sorry.
Come on.
I'm sorry. I'm just telling you.
Do I need to start classifying Madonna on my hate list along with Tom Cruise? I mean, I'm starting to wonder here. Do I have to expand my list?
Because they're freaks.
Well, yeah, but at least Madonna's bothering the Britons now. I love the Britons. They're our brothers in arms. But at least they're not bothering us Americans.
And it's funny to watch. I mean, come on. Because nobody takes her seriously. We can all just sit back and laugh. And in In an article, she said, "I can write the greatest songs and make the most fabulous films and be a fashion icon and conquer the world, but if there isn't a world to conquer, what's the point?" And I'm like,
"Oh, that
I'm
is
like,
great.
Whoa.
Wow,
like,
can you infuse okay. any more ego into that sentence?"
the most fabulous films, like Desperately Seeking Susan?
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Okay, she's officially away. On my list. That's it. Her and Tom Cruise are my the two people I want
to
shoot.
When we have to Madonna. We have to call that the Tom Cruise list because he tops it. So Madonna is now on the Tom Cruise list of crazy celebrities.
Oh God.
Okay. Right below Mel Gibson.
It's an endless list.
Yeah, Mel Gibson.
The list is legion. God.
All right. We have one more very important scientific follow-up. Very important.
Okay, pay attention.
Quiet down out there.
New research reveals that early man may have been feasted upon by ancient raptors. That's a bird, Perry.
Oh,
so this new study... Now,
time-traveling raptors? Cool.
To continue this very important discussion we've been carrying through this podcast.
Birds versus monkeys.
This is W. Scott McGraw, who's a researcher, looked at the bones, the remains of food from 12...
Look at the bones! Sorry.
1,200 African crowned eagle nests. And of the 1,200 remains, 669, that's more than half, belonged to monkeys.
There you go, Perry. Proven wrong yet again.
I did actually read this bit of fiction. we all know that birds and monkeys never existed at the same time in the history of the planet. So this is all hokum. These raptors never existed with the great apes. End of story.
All right, but Perry, please, for the scientific record, because we do have people out there that believe half the stuff we say, it did happen, and you're wrong.
Perry, this is your opportunity to grasp intellectual integrity, Perry, and admit that you were wrong.
Seriously, did the researchers look into the possibility that the birds played dirty? You know, maybe...
Were scavengers?
Yeah.
Maybe they dressed up like female monkeys.
Or maybe they bribed some of the other monkeys.
They characterized the birds as ambush hunters. They snatch them out of the tree.
I told you, playing dirty.
Yeah, they were
playing dirty.
Let's go on a limb, no pun intended, and let's say that these monkeys and birds were around at the same time. Okay, fine. What did they do? They found a couple of bones, right? Bird bones and monkey bones. How do they know that the monkeys didn't kill the birds?
No, these were found in bird nests, in the nests
of... How do you know the monkeys didn't go in there, snap the birds' necks, and live in the nests?
And also the monkeys had scrawled, "Oh God, help me," in berry juice.
Perry, that's actually a very good skeptical question.
Of course it is.
The answer is that the primate skulls had talon holes in them.
Once again, these are all assumptions. You don't know that there wasn't a king of the monkeys taking over the other monkeys and using their heads as bowling balls.
Yeah, maybe the monkeys killed the birds and used their talons as weapons against each other.
And that's another possibility. The possibilities are endless. Occam's razor. Cut off the ridiculous before you accept the insane.
You know what? God put those bones there to test us.
Could the monkeys have been dead and the birds just picked them up after they died?
Birds are well-known scavengers.
Not these birds, though. Now, this good professor has re-examined the punctures in the skull of the Tong child. This is one of the first Australopithecine fossils found. It was thought that the two holes in the skull of this fossil, early human, were probably from a large predatory cat. But he believes that they were from an ancient crowned hawk eagle.
Monkeys can beat birds.
All right, let's go on to emails. Email number one. This comes from Chris Hampton from Atlanta, Georgia, who writes, "I got into a discussion with my brother on the subject of strange archaeological finds. He made the statement that there are so many of these stories around that some must be true. At this point, my critical thinking alarm went off, and I told him that making a blanket statement like that was to be close-minded to the possibility that these things have plausible explanations or outright hoaxes. He seems to subscribe to the evil scientists concealing the truth theory. Is there any good, solid evidence of any of these stories being true, i.e. modern artifacts found in solid rock, etc.? So the short answer is no. There is no evidence that any of these things are true. I wanted to point out a couple of things. The statement that there are so many stories that some of them must be true is a common logical fallacy that we hear. The sort of the where there is smoke, there must be fire. Again, it based on some false assumptions. The notion is, if there are enough like UFO sightings, well, some of them must be true. If there are enough, you know, fantastical alternative medicine claims, there's got to be the diamond in the rough somewhere. Some of them,
enough
one
crop
of them,
circles
must be true.
Have been made, and some of them have to be from alien.
Right.
That assumes that there is some limit to how many false claims that there could be. Think about it. So if 5% of the UFO sightings have to be real because they can't all be fake, that means there's a million fake or false UFO sightings, just to put that's an arbitrary figure, in the last 10 or 20 years. But so why can't there be a million and 50,000 or a million and 100,000? Why can't they all be hoaxes or frauds or misidentifications or whatever? And that's the false assumption in that statement. Of course, they could be. So I thought it was interesting that he mentioned that and wanted to point that out. I did look for the modern artifacts sort of found out of place, the out-of-place artifacts, and that is a subcategory of archaeological pseudoscience. Some of these are like the Battery of Babylon. Have you guys heard about that?
Yeah, where they found a thing and they thought that it was a battery. And
it's some kind of clay pot and with chambers, and they said, oh, it looks like a battery because you could put acid in this chamber. But it's pure speculation. So, I mean, a lot of these are items that have some either plausible or even known contemporary mundane use, but the pseudo-archaeologists fantasize that it has some high technological, you know, application because of some superficial resemblance to some modern piece of technology. So they're not genuine mysteries often. Some of them are, for example, pieces of metal found in coal. And the metal, however, a lot of these were discovered in the 1800s. At the time, they weren't recognized for what they were, which are meteorites. They're just iron nickel meteorites. They looked unusually round, and they're pitted. They didn't look like the kind of ore that you would find on Earth. So it was assumed that maybe they might be worked by man. So here you have worked metal in ancient, you know, pre-technological beds. So that was a mystery. But of course, you know, now we recognize these things as being meteorites. So that's basically the level of mysteries that we're talking about here. There are none that are genuine mysteries. There are none that defy explanation. There are no demonstrably modern or technological items found embedded in demonstrably ancient strata. That's the bottom line. Next email comes from Captain M. Foreman.
I love this email.
Great email from Special Operations in Afghanistan. He writes, love the show. Not much in the way of entertainment in Afghanistan, so there is lots of time to think and listen to the 50 podcasts. Actually, this is number 58 we're up to. I stuck on my iPod. I think I am the first ever listener of your show during a mid-air refuel of a C-17. Add that one to your stats.
We did. We looked.
Yeah. Keep up the good work, and I look forward to future episodes if I could ever download them. I just wanted to include that email because, you know, it is very nice to hear from one of our men in uniform over in Afghanistan. I did respond to Captain Foreman and let him know that how much we appreciate the work that he's doing, and I thought it would be a good idea to take the opportunity just to thank all of the men and women in uniform who are fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq.
And are listening to our show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Past, present, and future for keeping us free. Thank you.
So, and despite the political divisiveness of these conflicts, the one thing that is, I think I could say is absolutely true, is that although Americans are divided on a lot of things these days, I think the one thing we are absolutely united on is our support for the troops.
Amen.
And, you know, I just want to say, any military folk out there in Iraq and Afghanistan, if you want to send in an address, I would love to send out a care package of Skeptic fun and maybe, you know, porn magazines and whatnot.
And the Skeptic calendar.
Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Rebecca, you could become the pinup girl of the Iraq War.
I would be okay with that.
Yeah.
Might be what that country needs to bring it all together. Finally solidify it over
the skeptic calendar.
Dr. Yeah, Rebecca, yeah. I love that chick. Hey.
She looks good in burka.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, in the last, in the 2006 calendar, we had a girl dressed up in a scarf. It's a good picture. Yeah.
Dressed all the way up in a scarf?
It was just the photo only showed her eyes, actually.
Huh? Cool.
Very nice. Very nice.
So, Rebecca, yeah, you might be able to add world peace to your long list of accomplishments.
I already have, actually.
Moving on.
Wow.
She's now looking to get Pluto reinstituted.
You'd be surprised how few employers actually follow up and check on things like that.
So. Rebecca is meeting with Madonna next week to go over this whole water thing.
One more email before we go on to our interview. This one comes from Matt Dick in Chicago, and Matt writes, on the last podcast, you all were discussing the hypothesis for an abiogenic origin for petroleum. After a really good interview, Rebecca mentioned that pseudoscience can invade any field, and that was the general consensus. I would quibble that abiogenic originated petroleum is not a pseudoscience. I may very well be wrong, but what is pseudoscientific about that? It's based on the very real evidence that some of the molecules in petroleum can be created without a biological component to the process. As one of you stated, it looks like the available and observable evidence would not support the amount of petroleum we see, and that largely the hypothesis doesn't fit well as the hypothesis, hence now probably theory, for the biological origin of petroleum. I suppose that conspiracy theories have surrounded it so it trips the pseudoscience trigger in you, but a perfectly reasonable hypothesis that does not require anything magical that happens to be disproven is not pseudoscience. In fact, it's the best kind of science. It's a hypothesis that is testable, or at least disprovable through observation. So, not to go to talk again about the abiogenesis of oil thing, but to talk about what this question brings up is the difference between science and pseudoscience.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know. I kind of feel like he has a good point, but when it comes to a disproven hypothesis that's then been disproven soundly, but then is taken and pumped up and had, you know, extra conspiracy theories and whatnot thrown onto it, that's
right.
When it becomes pseudoscience, when it's like undead science. It's theories that should be dead but are instead wandering the earth as zombie theories.
Right. No, I agree. I think he's committing a bit of a false dichotomy, and this is something that you know we have talked about before, but it's worth going over again. The notion that science and pseudoscience is not this pristine dichotomy. It's actually a spectrum, and there's lots of ways to be pseudoscientific. He was basically assuming that you have to be magical or paranormal or basically unscientific in order to be quote-unquote pseudoscientific, and that's not true. Pseudoscience can just be really bad science. At some point, it becomes so bad that it doesn't really even deserve the designation of legitimate science anymore. But the terminology is vague for that reason. You know, we basically tend to call anything that falls below a certain threshold as pseudoscience, but there's a lot of territory below that threshold. And there's a lot of distinctions to be made. I actually tried to come up with my science pseudoscience rating system, a 1 to 10 scale, 1 being solid science sufficiently well established to be considered a scientific fact, and 10 being demonstrably absurd, pure magical thinking and nonsense, with gradations in between. So we're gonna tweak this rating scale. We'll put it on the notes page and maybe on the forums as well. And maybe we'll use that in the future to rank pseudoscience to be more precise.
The claims in general, it's good.
All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Kimball Atwood. Kim, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
Dr. Atwood is an anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Tufts University School of Medicine. He is one of the associate editors of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. You're also an advisor on the NaturoWatch, a website dedicated to basically being a watchdog on the naturopathy, which is what we're going to be talking to you about tonight. And I also found that you were – are you still the chairman of the Committee on the Quality of Medical Practice of the Massachusetts Medical Society?
No, I am no longer that. Okay. I was that for a couple of years, ending a couple of years ago.
So, and Dr. Atwood is a colleague of mine. I'm also, if I've never mentioned this before on the show, I'm also an editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine, an associate editor. So we work together on that journal. And his focus is naturopathy or naturopathy. He has been involved with attempts by a naturopath to get licensure in Massachusetts, which is where you live, correct?
That's right.
So tell, you know, for our audience, can you give us a quick overview of what is naturopathy? What actually is it?
Let me start by saying that I'm going to limit the discussion to a group of naturopaths who refer to themselves as naturopathic physicians. They are distinguished from others who are sometimes called traditional naturopaths in that the group of interest is a group that has developed what I like to call the trappings of legitimacy in the modern world. Namely, they have actual campuses for their schools, and the students go there and live there and take courses for 4 years, as opposed to merely sending away for a correspondence course or nowadays some sort of an online course. At the end of that time, they receive a degree, which is typically called ND or naturopathic doctor. It's a bit confusing because some of the traditional naturopaths also claim to have that degree. Nevertheless, it's the naturopathic physicians or naturopathic doctors, as they call themselves, who are vying for licensure and recognition as legitimate primary health care providers throughout the United States. But both of those groups emanate from a tradition that probably began most notably in Germany in the late 19th century because of a notion that one could cure tuberculosis by jumping into frigid river waters, particularly the River Danube, and that was known at the time as the water cure. Later, some of the followers moved to this country, and one in particular, Benjamin Lust, L-U-S-T, ended up being kind of the founder of naturopathy in the United States. At this point, the naturopaths who believe that they are worthy of licensure as primary care physicians say that what they do is practice a form of medicine that is a harmony, a combination of what might be called conventional medicine on the one hand and what they refer to as natural medicine on the other. What they mean by natural medicine is essentially an eclectic hodgepodge of non-scientifically or modern medicine-based diagnostic and therapeutic methods such as homeopathy, aforementioned water cure, which can nowadays manifest itself as putting cold, wet blankets over people. Also, many of the other currently somewhat popular non-standard methods, including acupuncture, manipulation that's almost indistinguishable probably from chiropractic, certain features of osteopathy, such as craniosacral therapy.
And what's craniosacral therapy? Sorry.
Yes, craniosacral therapy is a method that is based on the idea that there are special rhythms that are distinguished from either respiratory variations or cardiac pulsations that exist throughout essentially the central nervous system. They're very subtle, and they can only be detected by the learned fingers of the expert practitioner. They're not detectable by any scientific instrument, for example. No strain gauge has managed to detect them. And somehow, by gentle manipulation, usually of the cranium, these rhythms, when they get out of balance, can be rebalanced in such a way as to affect all sorts of wonderful results, including curing learning disorders and even, according to some, curing mental retardation and other
things. All from a nice head massage, huh?
Exactly. and finally, probably the last but not least, in fact, probably the most important of the naturopathic claims currently is that they are experts in the use of what they call natural remedies, which means substances derived from animal, vegetable, or mineral sources, including virtually everything except, and there are even some exceptions to this, to that exception, synthetic pharmaceuticals. So all the so-called nutritional supplements and, you know, herbal remedies that are bandied about now in the popular domain, echinacea and all the other ones that you can think of, naturopaths claim to be the real experts on, and in fact fashion themselves as the very experts that the public needs now in light of Deshaies. You know, the law that essentially allows these agents to be sold with not nearly the rigorous kinds of study and restrictions and that sort of thing that real pharmaceuticals require.
Yeah, basically you could sell supplements broadly defined within the United States without any FDA oversight, without any really governmental regulation. But naturopaths specifically claim in their own pamphlets and propaganda, and I've certainly had individual practitioners make this claim directly to me, that they are experts in nutrition. So they are definitely trying to sell themselves as nutrition experts and then include under the umbrella of that supplements and herbal remedies and things that are not strictly nutritional, but that are considered quote-unquote natural, again, very broadly and not scientifically defined.
Well, that list Dr. Atwood just gave of naturopathies and what they claim was quite exhaustive. It sounds like they don't let, you know, one little bit of hokum escape their grasp.
That's right. As a matter of fact, if there's anything that characterizes them, it's an exuberant rush to embrace everything that the word hokum in healthcare is a good label for, and of course it's also usually stated in the same sorts of terms that lots of so-called complementary and health, you know, alternative medical practitioners use as far as science is concerned, and that is that to the extent that they feel that science supports what they say, then they want to trumpet that. And on the other hand, if science seems to oppose what they believe, then they manage to find, you know, numerous reasons why it should be dismissed as.
Yeah, so it's you know, heads I win, tails you lose, basically. If science seems to support something that they use, and they trumpet that, if it doesn't, it's because it can't be studied scientifically. Like,
it's the same old pseudoscientific march we have encountered countless times.
I would add, and I'm sure this is true for some, for many other fields and practitioners of the CAM mold, but it's especially true for naturopaths, and disturbingly so because they've caught the ear of officials in state legislatures and at the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine and other such lofty places. Also, the Medicare Coverage Advisory Committee has hired a couple of them. What they are also guilty of is simply claiming in a very kind of bold way that many of their claims are scientifically based, when in fact they're not at all. And the big book in naturopathic medicine is called the Textbook of Natural Medicine. It's a two-volume, you know, more than 2,000-page tome that proudly states on its back cover that, you know, it lists more than 10,000 references to peer-reviewed literature and blah, 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 among other acts of tedium that that I'm sorry to have been involved in to a certain extent over the last few years, has been the occasional investigation of that statement. And what I can tell you without the slightest reservation is that you can go to virtually any page in that textbook, and if you actually peruse the citations that are offered, they essentially do not support the claim that has been made. Typically, they're either restatements of the same opinion by somebody else, or a study that in many cases has absolutely nothing to do with whatever the claim is.
They're not citing primary research which establishes the claim that they're making. which is the implication given by having a reference.
Right, or even if they are citing primary research, which they sometimes do, it either is not really clinically relevant. In other words, it might be, for example, an in vitro, you know, a very small in vitro finding about some little thing in biochemistry or something.
In vitro meaning in a test tube, not in people.
Right. Yeah, I'll give you a specific example. The textbook claims that fish oils are effective at either preventing or treating probably 15 different unrelated medical problems. In response to a challenge by a reader of one of the articles that I wrote in Medscape General Medicine, I looked to see, for example, just what the evidence was that, for example, omega-3 fatty acids can prevent or alter the course of asthma, atherosclerosis, Crohn's disease, depression, diabetes, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and high blood pressure. So, if you look at the high blood pressure claim, for example, what you find is this statement, and now I'm quoting, quote, over 60 double-blind studies have demonstrated that either fish oil or flaxseed oil are very effective in lowering blood pressure. Now, the textbook offers four citations to support that statement. Without going into detail, I can tell you that the first two have nothing to do with it whatsoever. The third actually does have something to do with it. It's a review article of several primary articles looking at omega-3 fatty acids in various aspects of cardiovascular disease, including hypertension. And what it found was in some of them the studies were positive and in some of them they were negative, and overall the systolic blood pressure has typically been reduced by, and now I'm quoting from this particular review, 3 to 6 millimeters per mercury and diastolic pressure by 2 to 4 millimeters of mercury. Not very much. The fourth citation is also the second review of that same issue, fish oils in high blood pressure. And it found something similar, although a little bit less even, was the effect on blood pressure. And it turns out that, you know, first of all, none of the studies were double-blind, although you may recall that the quote that I gave was over 60 double-blind studies have demonstrated. And moreover, the most number of studies that you can conclude from these two reviews that, by the way, reviewed several of the same primary papers, the most positive studies that you can get out of looking at both of them is a total of 7. I don't know where the number 60 came from. You know, more recent looks at that whole issue, fish oils and hypertension, hypertension being high blood pressure, show that at best the effect is so small as to be certainly clinically insignificant. That's really the typical kind of thing that you find when you look at the citations in the textbook of natural medicine.
That's completely fascinating to me, just speaking as someone who used to be a mega hippie in Seattle. And I was working as an activist in Seattle, which is one of the hippiest towns I think I've ever lived in. And I was a vegetarian, and I had to go to a natural food store once, and I was talking to a naturopath about something, some random malady I had, and he was helping me out, and he said, oh, and you're a vegetarian, right? Well, you really have to take flaxseed oil. There's just, you know, it's the absolute, everybody takes it. You can't not take it if you're a vegetarian, or you will be completely unhealthy and near death. And I actually believed him, and even to this day, I always assumed that it was good for you. I never actually took it just because it was too fatty, and I my own vanity took precedence over what I thought might be my own health. But yeah, up until this moment, I actually just always assumed that it really was very good for you.
Well, what this example, I think, is it brings up, you know, a lot of times on this show, we talk about something as either scientific or unscientific. And what we mean by that is there are a few things, but one of the things we mean by that is just being intellectually rigorous and honest. You know, just common sense things. Like if you say these studies exist, they actually exist.
Right.
And the practitioners and the true believers that we criticize for being quote-unquote unscientific, it's because they do things like this. Like, they don't actually fairly and intellectually honestly represent the evidence that exists when making their claims. And naturopaths are no exception to that. They are intellectually not rigorous, and they are, in fact, often quite dishonest.
Yes, that's certainly true, and there are many more examples of that. On the website of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, which is the national organization for this group that considers itself to be trained to be primary care physicians, are several physician papers, almost any one of which could be cited as an example of what you just said, but one in particular that's both amusing and unfortunately dangerous is the one about treatment of streptococcal pharyngitis, which essentially says that naturopaths have been successfully treating streptococcal pharyngitis for close to 100 years with a combination of, I don't know, natural remedies and compresses or whatever it is, with a very low incidence of post-streptococcal sequelae. And what they mean by that, of course, is a very low incidence of acute rheumatic fever. They go on to say in that same physician paper that, oh, by the way, you know, we know when to refer somebody who we believe needs actual antibiotics. And they say exactly when that would be. And what it is that if the person hasn't responded to their ministrations in approximately 1 week, then they will refer in some cases, or if it's in Oregon, for example, where they have a much wider scope of practice than they will claim nationally. They probably prescribe or can prescribe penicillin themselves. But, you know, the trouble with all of that is that the whole reason for using penicillin in streptococcal pharyngitis is not to cure the sore throat. In fact, it has almost no effect on the natural history of the sore throat itself, which lasts typically 3 to 4 days, no matter what you do. The reason for giving penicillin, as was shown quite convincingly even back in the 50s, is that it prevents post-streptococcal rheumatic fever. It's because of the advent of penicillin in the late 1940s and its widespread use in the 50s that we virtually never see anymore. And we don't see it anymore because the cohort of children growing up in the 50s didn't get it. They didn't get it because they got penicillin when they had strep throats. You know, the trouble with, you know, the naturopathic physician paper is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that almost all the patients will get better from the sore throat within a week because that always happens. And on the other hand, some small percentage of them, historically it's anywhere from sort of 1 to 4% of people with untreated strep throat end up with rheumatic fever 2 to 4 weeks later. And it's a subtle diagnosis that naturopaths probably are ill-equipped to make. They've been told that their ministrations are virtually infallible. And so they are unlikely to believe, even if faced with something like that, that it might have anything to do with what they did or didn't do a few weeks prior to the time.
Doctor, just out of curiosity, what does it take to become a naturopath? Is that like 10 years of postgraduate study, or will a GED do?
The formal requirements for the group that I'm talking about are college followed by a 4-year school, and it's an on-campus school. There are 4, maybe about to be 5 in the United States and 1 in Canada that are approved. The most conspicuous among them are Bastyr University, that's B-A-S-T-Y-R, near Seattle in Washington, and the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, which is in Portland, Oregon. They don't have residency programs in the sense that medical doctors would think of those. There are now beginning to be some sort of rudimentary residency-type programs in the field. Some are 1 year, some are 2 years, but they also don't resemble the kinds of rigorous residencies that medical doctors have to go through.
What's the current status of licensure in the United States? How many states have licensure for naturopaths?
I have to tell you that I may not be absolutely up to date. The answer 2 years ago was 13.
The last count I had was 15.
Oh, okay, so.
but I thought that number was a couple years old.
It's going in the wrong direction. I think we can agree on that.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say that one of the things that the naturopaths are incredibly good at, and I saw it with my own eyes, is playing the political game.
Yeah.
They're very bad at thinking about how nature works, even though they claim to be experts on natural this and that. But they're very good at sizing up how politics works.
We have spoken many times of the tragedy of the level of scientific illiteracy among our politicians, federal, state, and local in the United States. It's a disgrace.
That is certainly true.
It's just not licensure in general. The issue is, and as you mentioned before, that naturopaths, they make the argument that they need to be licensed for quality control, and that's how they sell it to legislatures. But in reality, it really has nothing to do with quality control, because once they're licensed, they're really in control of their own licensure. Isn't that right? They just become
a
self-regulating body that it lends a false sense of legitimacy to what they're doing and nothing else.
That's correct. In addition to that, it does for them what the very thing that they complain is the reason that people like me are opposed to their licensure, which is, has nothing to do, by the way, with why I'm opposed to their licensure, but it is that they think that I'm trying, along with other medical doctors, to wage a turf battle with them. In fact, one of the things that they like about licensure for themselves is that they automatically get to win the turf battle that they are constantly fighting against their so-called traditional naturopath cousins.
And what about other countries, naturopathy abroad?
Canada has licensed naturopaths. If you get Terry Polyvoy's frequent emails about this or that, or you, yeah. If you lurk or even are active in the health fraud discussion list, you'll see tons of stuff about it there. There are notable naturopaths in the sense of you can find their writings online, that sort of thing, in both Great Britain and in Australia. But I confess to not knowing what the laws or the licensing statuses are in those places. And as far as, for example, the European continent is concerned, other than Germany, which undoubtedly has naturopaths, because that was from where they originally emanated.
Right.
This is an interesting little aside. They were favored by the Nazis.
Is that right?
So definitely there are naturopaths in Germany. And Germany, as you probably also know, is kind of a hotbed of other health chicanery, such as homeopathy, which is, Hahnemann also emanated originally from Germany.
Right.
Herbal medicines and that sort of thing. Lots of that stuff is popular in Germany.
I did find a New Zealand Society of Naturopaths, and just looking at the modalities that they use, they have listed homeopathy, iridology, which we've spoken about before, fascial kinetics, which is just massage, herbal medicine, Bowen technique, which is also massage, but I think the incorporating some life energy component, holistic pulsing, which is...
What's it called?
Pulsing. I guess they use the pulse for diagnosis and therapy. Reflexology.
Oh,
yes. You know
about. Right. Of course.
Urine analysis.
Yeah.
And HemoView. HemoView, which is... You take a drop of blood,
white blood cell analysis,
right, and just could look at the blood and diagnose all kinds of things just from looking at it.
Yeah, those things are all exist here, and in one form or another, for the most part, are taught to what I call the educated naturopaths. Yes, iridology or iridology. I once heard Stephen Barrett say, "Oh, the real pronunciation is iridology," but
does it really matter?
Of course not. That's taught at Bastyr. Applied kinesiology, you all probably know what that is. It's kind of a chiropractic favorite, is offered in continuing education courses that are formally approved by the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, for example. And there are lots of other things.
Yeah. like flim-flam, charlatan, snake oil, bunko, you know, sham artist, quackery. I'm sure it's all taught there.
A rose by any other name.
As we're talking about this, by the way, I realize that one of the key elements of naturopathy that I failed to mention in the very beginning, and if there's any one thing that almost is the thing that they can really call their own, it's the detoxification schemes,
mm-hmm.
mainly in their case, fasting and enemas.
Right.
Yes. And, you know, those things have been around for a long time and have not lessened in the slightest, even as the group that I'm talking about claims to, you know, to be scientifically based and have arrived in the modern world and that sort of thing.
Right. So that's basically the notion that these unspecified environmental toxins are assaulting our bodies and causing our ails and diseases, and that you can treat and cure these diseases by purging our bodies of these toxins in some way. You know, choose your method.
Right.
As you said, as it's coffee enemas or Rolfing is another mechanism.
Rolfing.
It's basically
yeah.
squeezing the toxins out of the muscles or whatever. Or
of course, for the most part, people who believe in that don't specify what the toxins are, but we're lucky to have such a field now that has become formally represented by its textbook and its schools and that sort of thing. So we now are told that the toxins, among other things, are immunizations,
right.
pharmaceuticals used by medical doctors, any preservative that you might want to mention,
right.
And that sort of thing. Yeah, I mentioned before that the Nazis liked naturopaths. In the early years of naturopathy, naturopaths coming from Germany had kind of a Teutonic disciplinarian view of the world in general and also the world of disease and health and that sort of thing. And they railed against things like smallpox vaccinations and the germ theory of disease, for example, because mm-hmm. they were absolutely convinced that people got ill essentially because they abused themselves all the time.
Right.
You know, it served them right to get ill. As a matter of fact, getting ill, for example, getting smallpox, was vastly preferable to being vaccinated against it, because essentially it taught your body really how to deal with such things. But it's ironic that over time, naturopathy has evolved into this field that is now embraced by, as we heard a little while ago, the hippie culture.
Right.
and it's fairly obvious that the reason for that is that the old toxin thing, you know, which in the old days the toxins were, you know, syphilis and smallpox. And
they were self-inflicted.
Right, and they were self-inflicted and all that stuff.
Well, I'm pretty sure syphilis isn't self-inflicted unless something's changed.
Well, it is in the way that it's your behavior, which...
But it was your own damn fault.
Oh,
the point is,
right.
It was your own damn
fault.
Wasn't
me, it was that tie hooker.
does that mean it was Hitler's own fault that he had syphilis? Shame on him.
Yeah. So, but now it's so easily has kind of segued, you know, and to use modern terminology, in a seamless way, it has segued into this kind of caricature of environmentalism,
right?
You know, where you know, all of the toxins in the air and the preservatives in food and everything else are now, those are the enemy, and you no longer need to.
It's very anti-corporate, which is very hippie.
Absolutely,
big corporations are assaulting us with these toxins.
So, Doc, right. You're saying that basically hippies, Nazis, and naturopathy are roughly equivalent.
Hey.
Watch it. I'm just trying to get it clear. I'm just trying
watch
to understand.
Watch it. It seems to me like it's just the culture kind of reacting to what's going on because, you know.
Right, exactly. It appeals to a certain, you know, kind of sort of social and political view. And yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because a lot of, you know, non-scientifically based, you know, health claims are like that. You know, all the language of early traditional Chinese medicine, as some of you undoubtedly know, has to do with, you know, armies and warriors and, you know, emperors and
Right.
You know, it's all kind of metaphorical in that sense.
Right. Well, that's a good point to end on. Kim, thanks for being on our show.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
Nice. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Take care.
Good night, Doctor.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay, bye.
Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Every week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real and one is fake. And then I challenge my esteemed panel of skeptical rogues to try to figure out which one is the fake. You guys ready?
You betcha.
Here we go.
Oh, ho, ho.
Number one, Oxford physicists propose resurrecting the ether to explain current mysteries about the structure of the cosmos. Item number two, scientists have bred a strain of permanently happy mice to use in depression research. And item number three, researchers at the University of Montreal claim to have found the God spot, the single location in the human brain responsible for religious belief. So, is it the ether, the happy mice, or the God spot? Evan, why don't you go first?
I think that number two is fiction.
Okay. You don't like the happy mice?
How could you not like happy mice?
It's just something, I don't know. It just doesn't sound right to me in a certain way. The resurrection of the ether and so forth, that's okay. I can sort of see that creeping up. The God spot, I think I have the most confidence in, because there probably is a biological component to that. Just that middle one, permanently happy mice, I don't know, a little too cartoony. So
okay.
I'll go number two is fiction.
They're calling them Mickey and Minnie.
My point has been made.
Perry?
Look, everyone knows that mice are born happy, live happy, and die happy. Mice are happy. It's clearly true. The God spot, of course. By the way, it's not in the brain. It's down. And then the ether, you know, there could not possibly be. You said there were scientists, Steve?
Oxford physicists.
There is no way that some physicist is rebirthing life into the ether. I mean, come on.
You stupid monkey.
That's steampunk. That's
maybe
out.
It was someone from Harvard, not Oxford.
That one,
that one
is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
I like the idea of permanently happy mice. Although I picture them making the mice and saying, "Oh my God, we've made these mice so happy. Now we can help these depressed people by giving them the happy mice, because then, you know, how could you not be happy when you have happy mice?" I'm really
point.
Not with it tonight. I apologize.
No, you're quite lucid.
You should have passed.
you're as cogent as ever.
Oh, screw you. the God spot thing, I'm pretty sure that I saw something about this recently, but I didn't actually read the article. So I'm kind of kicking myself now. But I get the feeling that there's some trick question thing going on there. I'm going to say that that's the false one, even though I think it's the true one. And so I'm...
All right, we got the idea, Rebecca.
I'm going to fake myself out.
Special pleading.
I'm thinking that Steve's trying to fake us out somehow, so I'm going with the God spot as the false one.
Alrighty, Jay.
Happy mice, of course they can make happy mice. I mean, why wouldn't they be able to do that? There is no ether. There never will be an ether. There's no hyperspace. Ether, whatever.
Say it again. Ether.
Doesn't exist. Never will. That one's fake. Everybody knows it.
Okay. Well, you guys spread yourself out, so I couldn't get all of you this time. I thought I might do that. Let's start with the happy mice. The happy mice is science.
Uh-huh.
Of course.
Researchers breed permanently happy mice. They have been studying a gene called TREC1. Which can affect the flow of a brain chemical called serotonin. So, which is the happy hormone, as everyone knows, the happy neurotransmitter.
Right.
And publishing in the journal Nature Neuroscience, which is quite prestigious, by making a mutation in the TREC1 gene, they were able to breed these permanently happy mice. They said, the researchers said, depression is a devastating illness which affects around 10% of people at some point in their life. This is Guy Debenel from McGill University in Montreal, Canada, principal author on the paper. And he said current treatments fail for a third of the patients. So, I mean, obviously the hope is with this that by studying the changes in brain chemistry and by studying the effects of mutations in this gene, that this might lead to new targets for antidepressant drugs and improved treatments.
Does that mean that these mice are all Trekkies? Oh!
Yeah, I didn't think so. I didn't think everyone was going to miss that. Let's go on to item number one. Oxford physicists propose resurrecting the ether to explain current mysteries about the structure of the cosmos. Now, when I first read this, my reaction was pretty much the same as Perry and Jay's. The ether? That's been gone for about 150 years. Actually, it was the Michelson-Morley famous experiment of 1887 that proved conclusively that there is no all-pervading ether in space. And this was one of the things that led to the special theory of relativity, which is basically the notion that everything, space and time, are relative, that there is no universal frame of reference. Initially, the ether was the idea that, well, since sound propagates through air, that light, which is also a wave, must also propagate through something. So let's say that light propagates, or electromagnetic waves propagate through the ether. But they basically proved that there was no ether. And relativity is the notion that there is no fixed reference points like an ether through which light moves. Light, in fact, moves at the same speed to every reference. So there's no privileged or fixed frame of reference. Well, now physicists at Oxford are proposing to resurrect the notion of a fixed point of reference, reincarnating the notion of the ether, not in the exact same form as pre-Michelson-Morley, to solve the puzzle of dark matter. And they basically, by positing a field, an ether-like field that pervades space-time, this is, if you removed everything else in the universe, the ether is what would be left behind. This is Dr. Zolznick. The ether field isn't to do with light, but rather is something that boosts the gravitational pull of stars and galaxies, making them seem heavier. It does this by increasing the flexibility of space-time itself.
Interesting.
What? This guy's a doctor? What is he, a veterinarian?
He's a naturopath.
He made the mortal sin of disagreeing with Perry.
Is he a chiropractor? What?
He's a phrenologist.
Now, of course, the big problem with this notion is that it does away with the it contradicts special relativity by forming an absolute frame of reference.
It's stupid. That's the problem with it.
Dr. Carroll
fooled you.
I don't think the problem is that it is stupid, Perry.
Trust me, honey. It's stupid. Thank you.
Your argument is foolproof.
The ether? I mean, it's been gone for 150 years.
Yeah, but that's the nature of cosmology. I mean, Einstein came up with the cosmological constant. Then he said that was the biggest mistake of his career, and this is whatever that was, 50, 60 years ago. But now, cosmologists are resurrecting the notion of an expanding universe, an expanding force, an accelerating or expansive force in the universe. So it would not be without precedent. But the physicists say this. They say a couple of things that are worth note. One, this is Ferreira, who says, the onus is definitely on us to pin this theory down so it doesn't look like yet another fantastical explanation. So they're properly placing the burden of proof on themselves. When asked about the whole problem with the frame of reference in special relativity, another one of the physicists, Carroll, said, interestingly, this controversial aspect should make it easy to test for experimentally.
If the ether turns out to be true, I'll move to Iran and become a Muslim and I'll raise birds. Okay? That's my problem. I'm putting it out there right now.
We're going to hold you to it, Perry.
Oh, damn right.
Damn right. All right. And if it's not true, I'm flying over there and telling the doctor he's a living baboon.
So either way, we get a good show.
That's right.
Now, number three.
So, yeah, let's not detract from the focal point here is that number three is right.
That Rebecca got right. Lucky.
Lucky? Did you not hear? Did you not hear when I detailed my process of picking out the
You didn't actually
the
read the article?
Answer.
Yeah, there was an article on the God spot in the news this week, but I reversed the findings.
See, I knew it.
So the way I read it was that researchers at the University of Montreal claimed to have found the God spot, the single location in the human brain responsible for religious belief, when in actuality, the title of the paper is that the brain scan of nuns finds no single God spot in the brain. In fact, they disproved the notion of a God spot, or again, just one part or one region of the brain that is by itself responsible for the experience of religion or belief in God. In fact, the mystical experiences are mediated by several brain regions, ones that also function for the functions of self-consciousness, emotion, reality testing, and body representation. So these are largely frontal lobe and limbic areas, the parts of the brain that are most greatly expanded in humans compared to our closest living relatives like chimpanzees.
So what you're saying, I was right?
That's correct. So Rebecca okay. got this one correct.
Just thought yes. I'd wrap
I recall your explanation being something about how you were out of it this evening.
Yeah, to succeed despite being out of it. That's very true.
Well, it's just that I couldn't. I couldn't express what I was trying to say, but I could still think it. You see,
to err is human; to stumble into it is Rebecca. Good job.
Well, let's give the answer to last week's puzzle. No new puzzle this week, but we're going to give the answer to last week's puzzle. This one was written by Evan, who is with us here tonight.
Oh, hello, so Evan. If that is your real name.
Read the puzzle once again and give us the answer.
A man, a chemist, a pastor by trade, in search of a cure he thought he had made. For the prevention and cure of scurvy, he wrote, his newest discovery he had hoped to gloat. The public's belief in this product was fast. Dermatitis and rheumatisms would be things of the past. As time passed on and the ills still remained, the product itself would garnish new fame. Still the pharmacies sold it, it would become a tradition. People bought it by the hundreds, the thousands, and millions. For that man long ago, we must give our thanks, while he tinkered with elements, currents, and plants. And though he did not rid the world of rickets or piles, to billions of people we attribute their smiles. So, who was he, and what was his discovery?
Evan, you're no rapper or Dr. Seuss.
Was he Sir Mix-a-Lot?
Excuse me, I derived my inspiration from the legendary Paul Harvey. Thank you very much.
Oh my God.
And the answer is,
Joseph Priestley.
And his invention?
His invention was carbonated water.
Carbonated
soda.
Water.
So let's get to the important part. Still the pharmacies sold it. It would become a tradition. People bought it by the hundreds, the thousands, and millions.
Those do not rhyme.
Dr. Seuss would smack your teeth right out of your mouth if he was still alive.
I like carbonated water, Evan, I do. I like carbonated water.
It's true.
Spread on my do.
Sweet God.
I like it mixed up.
So did anybody get the answer right? Did we get any
No correct answers on this one.
No
this one.
Correct
it's
answers.
Because they fell asleep halfway through the freaking poem.
Oh, come on. Please.
You know,
this is classic.
I have an idea for this week's puzzle. I think we should test the remote viewing abilities of our listeners.
Excellent.
I have a playing card, and I'm going to sit it on my windowsill, face down. No, I'll put it face up. You know, we'll play fair. And I live in Boston. That's the only hint you get. And so, listeners, go ahead and remote view. It's a normal playing card from a normal deck laying on my windowsill.
Oh, it's not the Two of Cups or the...
No tricky stuff like that. It's not the Joker. It's not the rules. It's just your normal average playing card. Write in and tell me what it is. And if you first person to get it right gets mentioned.
Alrighty.
Three of diamonds.
Wow. Yeah.
Damn, that's what I was going to say.
That's your last hint. It's not the three of diamonds.
Yeah, what are the odds that somebody could just randomly guess?
1 in 51?
Well, yeah, now they're 1 in 51.
All right, well, we are mercifully out of time. Thank you all for joining me again.
Thank
pleasure,
you.
As always.
Hey, Steve, why don't you ask our listeners to go on iTunes and leave us good feedback?
Well, I think more importantly, those of you who are downloading the show episode by episode off the site, it's much easier to just get iTunes and go on there and you can subscribe and it will automatically download each episode for you. And we get better ratings for that.
There you go.
Or you could download it from Yahoo Podcasts or one of the other
iTunes.
Pod servers. But iTunes is far and away the most popular.
And they can join us on MySpace as well.
We're all over the place. We're taking over the net.
And the forum. Let's not forget the forum.
And visit us on our forums. Lots of lively discussions. Thanks again for joining me, everyone. Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other podcasts, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.